So hi everyone, thank you for being there. I'm very happy to be here today to talk to you about some work with Misha Woods that we did at ETH Zurich. So Misha is in the process of moving to France for a new position now. And so this work is about the system loophole of generalized non-contextuality. So we'll talk about what that might be. I guess I should give some generic remarks about why it's interesting to look at non-contextuality. So non-contextuality is a very interesting notion because it allows us to partition the world into quantum phenomena, like truly quantum phenomena and classical phenomena. And that's an interesting, a very interesting thing to do because that can help get a very precise understanding of some mysteries of what is truly mysterious, what is not, and so on. So this is always interesting to do. And so to start with, Yes. Okay. So let me give some very generic remarks about systems in notions of non-classicality and the type of role that they play. So in Bell non-locality, we typically look at two systems that Alice and Bob hold. Right. That's like the simplest case. So, So Bell non-locality is a notion of classicality that is applicable to at least two systems, right? And the relevant features that this notion of classicality exposes with respect to the systems is how they are separated to each other, typically. So you have to talk about the space-like separations of the two systems to talk about Bell non-locality. Whereas non-contextuality has a greater scope. It's applicable to a single system, which is very interesting because we want to be able also to categorize a single system as being sort of classical or quantum. And so it exposes, in doing so, the exact extent of the system, so to speak, as that will be the topic of this talk. We'll talk about this all the time, but let me already give you some trailer of where systems appear in non-contextuality. So this is a screenshot from the original 2005 paper, where it is stated that P is equivalent to P prime, so P and P prime are preparation procedures. So P is equivalent to P prime if P and P prime give the same statistics for all measurements, right? So the notion of equivalence is sort of comes from a notion of indistinguishability. I will typically talk about indistinguishability, not equivalence, but that's just like a choice of terminology. And here we have this for all M, right? And what does that mean? Well, the point is we should evaluate the equivalence of P with respect to P prime for all measurements on the system. Right. That's sort of the understanding. But what is the system, right? And is this like an obvious notion, or is there perhaps some debate to have about how it's defined and what role it plays? And to give some motivation for why that might not be trivial, let me talk about some possible universe subsystem ontologies. So some beliefs one may have about the true nature of the relationship between the whole universe and its subsystems. So here on the left, we have a fuzzy universe, which is sort of continuous at all scales, where there's always some stuff happening, no matter how far you zoom in, right? And in such a universe, subsystems are rather effective. It's not like this fuzzy universe naturally partitions itself into components, right? Subsystems are rather like, choices we make, at, where we want to look at for a given experiment and so on, right? Whereas on the right, we have a composite universe that is, we are thinking of an ontology of the universe where, fundamentally speaking, the universe is made out of unit constituents, which are really like fundamental subsystems that together build up the universe. Right? So these are sort of two, perhaps, extremes, two beliefs one could have about the true nature of the universe. And they give different notions of systems. And so potentially, they give different notions of non-contextuality. That's the sort of thing we want to talk about today. And traditionally, or typically, non-contextuality is understood, or at least it's best understood, if we assume sort of a composite universe with some fundamental subsystem. There, it's very clear how non-contextuality works, how to use it, and so on. And so in this work, we want to look more generally at non-contextuality in a greater landscape, where we allow ourselves to have maybe different notions of systems, maybe we want to compare different notions of systems, and what kinds of notions of non-contextuality they give, and so on. So the plan to do that, the methodology we will use, has sort of two steps. The first step is to remove systems entirely from the picture and to look at relative non-contextuality, which is simply non-contextuality without systems. So really like trying very hard to avoid any mention, any sort of bias you may have about what constitutes a system and so on, really try to do non-contextuality there. So we'll talk about that, how it's defined, and some results about that you can get in this framework. To see, you know, what it would be like if we had no systems in non-contextuality. And then we will reintroduce different notions of system. So we will enrich relative non-contextuality with some ideas of what systems might be. And we will see, yeah, what sort of notions of non-contextuality we get then. That's the plan. So let's start with relative non-contextuality. And I should say, if you have any question during the talk, feel free to interrupt. That's, yes?
So back to the last one. Am I right thinking that non-contextuality with systems could be interpreted as sort of non-contextuality without a notion of topographic completeness of your set of measurements and preparation?
Yes, indeed. So in many works on contextuality, there is a notion of tomographic completeness that appears, and that's this. I would you know, at least for the purpose of this talk, I would call it an assumption about a system. So your assumption of tomographic completeness can be related to a notion of system. So like the system is sort of the abstraction, the conceptual abstraction of that.
Thank you.
Just drink. Up. Okay. So let's look at relative non-contextuality. And so first, let us restrict the scope to prepared measure scenarios. We restricted the scope to prepared measure scenarios, so I cannot tell you about more than that for now. We'll discuss at the end a bit what we might have missed by looking only at prepared measure scenarios, but that's what we have so far. So prepared measure scenario consists of two sets at first, EPM and SPM. So let's look at SPM first. So SPM is a set of preparation procedures. So the label S is related to a state. I mean, we call it S because we think of states, but okay. So SPM are preparations. And so preparation S is essentially just a list of instructions that you do in the lab. So it's like an ordered set of actions that you have. And so this preparation S could be you have to press the blue button and then turn the red knob. Okay. An effect is very much like a preparation procedure, except at the end it has a success condition here, right? So it's like a list of instructions, and then at the end there's a condition about the observation of a classical event in some sort of like underlying classical algebra of events that you can observe. Yes. So this description here, with just like you know a sequential list of actions, and then for the effect an extra success condition, you can enrich it by saying that you can have conditional branching that happen in the instructions, where you know you execute one instruction, and then depending on what you observe, you do you know one of two things, and so on and so forth. But in the simplest case, this is what will take preparations and effects to look like. So we can chain an effect after a preparation, formally that's another effect. So here, E after S looks like the three first parts are just the action list. So first the actions of S, and then the actions of E, and then the success condition of E. And the probability of E given S is interpreted as the success probability of that sort of joint procedure that we have here. We don't really say where this probability comes from, but we just assume we know it, or we have a prescription for it. Yes. And here I want to point out that the division between E and S is to some extent arbitrary, right? Because formally we see that effects and preparations are very similar. Right, like an effect with a trivial condition is like a preparation and so on. So the point is that this cut between what we take in the effects and the preparation is related to the fact that we will build ontological models and non-contextual models for these. So essentially you should think of this partition as being the partition for which we want an ontological model. That's sort of the idea. Okay. So actually, a prepared measure scenario is not just a set. It's rather, we want to look at the convex hull of the sets of effects and preparations. The reason is that we want to have a classical randomness in a way that's very explicit. So the previous formalism I described allows for an action that's like throw a dice and then you look at the outcome. That's allowed. But we want it to be like explicitly modeled in the framework to be able to have some constraints related to this classical randomness. So a point in the interior of this set, so little s here, I call it a preparation density by analogy with the density operators we have in quantum mechanics. So preparation density is just a classical mixtures of pure preparations, and an effect density is a mixture of effects. And then the full data really of the prepared measure scenario is the set of probabilities of little e given little s, which are related to the previous probabilities that we just discussed by convex linearity. So that's just to say that we have sort of a consistency requirement between the probabilities we have and the convex linearity, we have a consistency requirement between the probabilities and the classical randomness that we allow ourselves to play with, right? So a mixture of effects gives like mixtures of probabilities and so on. So that's the prepared measure scenario. So then let's look at ontological models. So we'll here only talk about ontological models, and then later we'll bring in the constraints of non-contextuality. And be aware also that what counts as an ontological model and a non-contextual one, like where do you place the cut, where do you place each assumption is to some extent arbitrary. So I will just pick such a partition into ontological models and extra constraint of non-contextuality, but okay. So an ontological model is a construction on top of the prepared measure scenario. So each preparation density is mapped to, so each preparation little s is mapped to mu of s. That's an ontic-state distribution. And it looks like a distribution here over some lambda. That's, you know, just some variable over some set. And lambda is thought of as being an ontic state, so like a true state of the system, right? And so mu of s describes the probability that when we thought of we were doing, you know, the preparation s, which is like an operational preparation, actually we prepared the ontic state lambda with the corresponding probability, you know, probability of lambda given s. And this mapping mu s should be convex linear in s, which is to say that the classical randomness that we have for the preparation should be compatible with the sort of ontological randomness that we have in the sense that operational mixtures are implemented as ontological mixtures. That's for effects, each effect density little e is mapped to psi of little e, an ontic response function, which maybe looks a bit like that. So for each lambda, psi of lambda is like the probability of E given lambda. It's the probability of success of the effect if we had really the ontic state lambda. That's what it's meant to be, right? And again, yeah, this has to be convex linear in E for the same reasons. And so far, this is a bit trivial if we don't impose some sort of consistency with what we observe. So the consistency, of course, requirement is that the probabilities that we see at the operational levels have to be reproduced by the ontological models in the way you would expect, which is that you succeed the effect E given S if, you know, on average over lambda, where you weigh each lambda by the probability mu S lambda, you succeed this psi E of lambda. Okay, I'm trying to explain Bayes' rule in words, but you get what it means. Okay, so that's an ontological model, and the problem is that they always exist. So although it looks like we've introduced a lot of nice structure, I mean, we have, this is sort of not enough to have an interesting notion of classicality that will, you know, be non-trivial, because this notion on its own will always tell you that any prepared measure scenario is classical. So that's not enough. We want to add some extra requirements. And that's where non-contextuality will come. And before we can talk about non-contextuality, we need to talk about these equivalence relations that I was mentioning at the beginning, which come from indistinguishability relations. And so here I want to talk about distinguishability relation with respect to an explicit reference. Okay. So we have a prepared measure scenario, and we want to say that two preparation densities are equivalent. For that, we need to introduce another set, which I call EREF. So that's a set of reference effects. And we will say that two preparation densities, S1 and S2, are equivalent with respect to the reference effects, with respect to EREF, if and only if S1 and S2 yield the same probability of success for any E that's in the reference set of effects, right? So this is really like completely the same as you know, the screenshot which we saw in the first slide, except we're just giving a name to this set of measurements. Yes. And, you know, completely symmetrically, we have that for effects, two effect densities E1 and E2 are equivalent with respect to the reference states in SREF, if and only if, well, they give the same probabilities for all preparations in the reference preparations. Yeah, so that's our indistinguishability relations with respect to explicit reference procedures. And for now, yeah, maybe let me comment already a bit on what these could be. So for the purpose of relative non-contextuality, there can be any sets of effects preparations. But you know, maybe some reasonable choice are somehow EREF is some sort of superset of EPM, maybe, right? Like, or maybe if you have some underlying notion of system, EREF will be some sort of like tomographically complete set of measurements related to that system, and so on and so forth, right? But so far, they are arbitrary. Okay, so now we can introduce relative non-contextuality using this notion of indistinguishability. And here there's a typo. a non-contextual ontological model for the prepared measure scenario relative to an explicit reference is an ontological model for the prepared measure scenario such that whenever two preparation densities S1 and S2 are equivalent with respect to the reference effects, they are implemented as the same ontic state distribution. And similarly, when two effect densities are the same with respect to the reference states, they are the same ontic state, ontic response functions. In other words, the indistinguishability relations on the prepared measure scenario with respect to the reference are implemented as identities in the ontological model. And just to clarify, in this definition, the ontological model is really valid for the prepared measure scenario itself only. So the domain of mu here, the S's here should only be in the convex hull of SPM, not SREF. That's like a choice. If you want to describe your reference procedures in the ontological model, then, well, you can just include them in the prepared measure counterpart. So essentially, you should place here the procedures for which you want an ontological model, and here those you use for the indistinguishability relations, and so far the relation between the two is sort of arbitrary. Okay, so that's the notion of relative non-contextuality. And now let's look at a few results that we can have in this framework. The first is the case of perfect distinguishability. That's interesting to look at because you might think initially, for the reference, you know, states and effects, let's just take everything out there, right? Well, that's a bad attitude because you will get a trivial notion of classicality. So suppose that in your set of effects that you use as a reference, you include a special set of effects that are labeled by S, the preparations in your prepare and measure scenario, such that the effect ES always succeeds after the preparation S, otherwise always fails, right? So ES is like an indicator of the preparation S. And intuitively, you can think of this sort of set of measurements as being the lab notebook measurements, where you explicitly write down everything you do in the lab in a lab notebook, and then you allow your reference effects to include measurements that just look at what you did, basically, right? That allows you trivially to distinguish everything. So if that sort of measurements is included in your reference effect, it turns out that there exists a non-contextual model for the prepared measure scenario relative to that reference. So that shows that you should not, you know, allow for anything to be in the reference, otherwise you have something trivial. So here there's a little caveat. The reference has also to be a faithful reference, but okay, we'll come back to that. Okay. Let me drink. Yeah, so we should really restrict the reference if you want something non-trivial. Okay, so we should not look at arbitrary large references. We should look at, you know, other types of references. Is there any, you know, notion of order between them? Well, it turns out that there's a very natural notion of order. Actually, it's a pre-order, technically, which is related to which reference is better than which other reference, right, at distinguishing the procedures of the prepared measure scenario. So suppose we start with a reference here, EREF1, SREF1, the first reference, and we have another one, EREF2, SREF2, which maybe has more preparations and effects somehow. We will connect it with this arrow, that's like a pre-order relation symbol in some sense, that's defined with respect to a prepared measure scenario. And that means, in words, that the second reference is better than the first at distinguishing the procedures in the prepared measure scenario. And the way we can capture that formally is by saying that, this pre-order relation holds if and only if, for all the equivalence relations of two effect densities in the preparameter scenario with respect to the preparations of the second reference. All of these must have already been present in the with respect to the first reference, right? So you can, yeah. Whereas the converse implication doesn't go, right? So it means you can only remove indistinguishability relations in this preorder. And the same goes for the state. So if you had, if the second reference gives you some indistinguishability relation, then it has it had to be also there with the first one. So that's the notion that, yeah, this reference is better than the first, that's it. And that defines a preorder, which is reflexive and transitive. So reflexive just means that every reference is like better than itself, right? So it's like a you know kind of like less than or equal to type relation, and transitive means that well okay if x is better than y is better than z then x is better than z. Okay.
In the first one, if s is distinguishable from s two, then in the second one, s is one is also.
Yes, yes, maybe that's a better way to, yeah, maybe the contrapositive is clearer actually. So yeah, if S1 and S2 are not, so if they are distinguishable with respect to the first, they are also distinguishable with respect to the second, right? So yeah, that's saying that this one is not worse than the first. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So now let's see how this notion of reference preorder plays with relative non-contextuality. So we can make the following statement. If a reference one is, I mean, if the reference two is better than the first, right, with respect to a preparameter scenario, then it induces fewer indistinguishability relations, which means it induces fewer constraints in a non-contextual model, which means it's only easier to construct a non-contextual model, right? Which means that if there exists a non-contextual model for the preparameter scenario with respect to the first, then that same model is also valid with respect to the second reference. Right, so the reference preorder is sort of that's sort of why it's interesting, right? It's sort of a monotone of classicality. I don't know how to call it. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now we've looked. Ah, sorry.
No?
Ah, that's my. Okay. Yeah. So we've looked at you know very bad references. They're bad. We've looked a bit at the order between different references. Now we can ask ourselves how small can we go for the reference. And that's where the notion of faithful references come into play. So faithful references are references that are not too small in some sense. So to understand that, we can formulate the following sort of lemma, which is that if there exists a contextual model for a preparameter scenario with respect to a reference, then that reference cannot be you know, arbitrarily small in some sense. It has to be at least as good as the preparameter scenario itself with respect to this preorder relation. So every reference that you know has a chance of allowing for a non-contextual model has to be at least as good as the preparameter scenario itself, which just means that yeah we should choose the references. We should basically only look at references that are yeah better than the preparameter scenario itself if we want to look at interesting things. Otherwise, we will trivially get that there does not exist a non-contextual model. And by definition, we will take this relation here to define what a faithful reference is. A faithful reference is just one that's at least as good as the preparameter scenario in that sense. Okay. So now we can bundle all the things I mentioned into one sort of picture, which is a picture of the relative non-contextuality graph.
Sorry, can you go back to the slide?
Yeah. Sorry.
You're saying that all we know in the beginning is the ref and if you use them as the reference frames to say like things which are indistinguishable relative to those, which are treated as indistinguishable in the ontological model, then you're capable of building a potential ontological model. But maybe it's the case that EREF and SREF are smaller.
Yeah.
And they don't distinguish as much. EPM and SPM things are distinguished, which are not distinguished relative to EREF and SREF.
Yeah.
It's still the case.
Well, then there, in the scenario described, there cannot exist a non-contextual model. So if you have that two, okay, so let's take a simple case. Suppose you have two preparations in SPM that are not equivalent with respect to the data table of the pre-parameter scenario. But suppose your reference effect is just like somehow like the empty set or something very, very small, and they are equivalent, then you cannot have an uncontextual model, because when you look at the consistency rule between the probabilities in the ontological model and the operational probabilities and the uncontextual assumption, like it will clash sort of trivial. So that's why you need sort of these faithful references. Yes. And by the way, yeah, this condition is sort of trivially satisfied if EREF is a superset of EPM and if SREF is a superset of SPM, right? Then it sort of trivially works. But it's not the general case. The general case is sort of this relation, right?
So Victor, just a question.
Yeah.
I think I mistakenly understood it earlier in your talk that you were thinking of SREF as a subset of SPM, but no, it could be a superset.
Yes. So at this point, let's say before this slide, SPM and SREF were arbitrary set. They had no relation. I mean, they could have, of course, right? But you are free to choose the sets you wanted, right? But typically, the thing that's sensible, yeah, is to take SREF to be a superset of SPM. That's sort of what makes sense. And this slide is sort of what justifies that, basically, because if you want, yeah, a chance for a non-contextual model, you need SREF to be essentially at, okay, it doesn't need to be like a bigger as a set, but it needs to be at least as good as distinguishing things than SPM is in some sense. So in some sense, you could also take SREF to be sort of a tomographically complete subset of SPM. That might still give you a faithful reference. But if you take SREF to be a superset of SPM, you're guaranteed to have a faithful reference. I mean, you need the same for the effect. Okay. So yeah, okay, so let's take all the things we mentioned and let's, yeah, draw them together in one thing, in the relative non-contextuality graph or tree or Haas diagram, as I've learned from Wikipedia recently. So let's fix a pre-parameter scenario EPM, SPM, and we vary the reference. Okay. So I draw a bunch of points here. Each point represents one choice of reference. So here we have the kth reference, here we have the jth reference. And I will connect them with arrows if, well, they satisfy the corresponding pre-order relation. So here, the kth reference is better than the jth reference. So let's do that for the whole graph, and suppose we arrive at something like that, where we omit the edges that you can obtain by transitivity, right? Because that would just clutter the drawing. And then let's, for each vertex, so for each reference, let's put a blue square if there exists an contextual model for the pre-parameter scenario relative to, well, that reference. And if there does not exist an contextual ontological model relative to the reference, we put a red circle. So let's do that for the whole graph. And that's sort of the typical thing that you probably arrive at. So it's impossible to have these sort of connections between edges. So you cannot have a blue vertex that's connected to a red vertex in that way. That's because of the lemma we saw, right? So if you have an ontological model for this vertex, well, it's still valid for this reference, which is better than the previous one, right? So this is impossible. If you have a blue thing here, it has to be connected to something blue on top, which is why here this vertex had to be blue and this one had to be blue. When you go very high up the tree, you should expect classicality, or I mean, you should expect the existence of a non-contextual model with respect to these references. And that's because, you know, once you have, in particular, perfect distinguishability, as we saw, you have a non-contextual model. So we should expect that when we make the references larger and larger, at some point, we reach classicality. And at the very root of the tree, it makes sense to put the pre-parameter scenario itself. And that's because of the faithful reference business we were discussing. So every reference that's interesting to look at is a faithful reference, which means it's a reference that has an edge from the pre-parameter scenario itself to that reference. And so, yeah, so that's why like all the things we will look at will be sort of connected to the pre-parameter scenario like that. So the root of the tree is sort of the pre-parameter scenario itself, and then we can go up, and once we arrive sufficiently up, we are pretty much guaranteed to have classicality at some point. It could very well be that already from the perspective of the pre-parameter scenario itself, we have classicality, we have a blue vertex, which means the whole graph would be blue, right? That's completely possible. But like the more visually interesting case is the one where this one is non-classical, and then, you know, classicality emerges as you go up the branches like that.
Question?
Yeah.
You said that the only reference systems worth considering are those that are faithful.
Yeah.
Is that supposed to be obvious? Again, it depends what purpose you want to put this stuff to, but can you say a bit more about like why would I not consider an unfaithful reference?
Yes, that's a good question. So I guess, I guess I say that because I sort of know the proof here, right? Maybe, yeah. So the proof of this is sort of like a trivial contradiction in some sense. So if you assume, in the contrapositive, right? So if you have a non-faithful reference, so if this condition is wrong, then it's very easy to show that there does not exist a non-contextual model, sort of trivially by construction in some sense. So that sort of non-classicality assessment, so an assessment of non-classicality with respect to an unfaithful reference is very clearly a trivial one in some sense. So that's why I say that it's not so interesting to look at them. Also, it doesn't depend on, you know, the actual statistics of the preparameters. It doesn't depend on anything. It's just like, yeah.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying that something is estimated to be classical relative to the SPM, EPM, then it should be just non-classical. And if you find some reference that relative to which that's classical, well, you know, that's kind of a misdiagnosis of classicality. That somehow we should trust the verdicts of non-classicality that EPM and SPM deliver.
No, that's not. So actually, I should have done it. So here, suppose you add some vertices, some references that are not connected to this root here, right? So suppose you add some references that are not connected by a direct edge. That are not connected by a direct edge from the root to these other references. So suppose you submerge that tree in a sea of unconnected vertices. All those vertices will be guaranteed to be red, non-classical, always.
Would we first think about like as the contextually analog of bilinear signaling inequality, right? That there's no possibility for non-locality if you don't even satisfy these equality constraints. We're not evaluating the actual numbers. It's just wrong to begin with.
Yeah.
Is what you said true, even if that bottom node were blue?
Yes.
And everything was blue.
Yeah. There will still be a sea of red nodes around it. Yeah, exactly. Okay, should I be putting these pictures? Yes. So even if this node was blue and the whole like interesting tree was blue, there would still be like a sea of unconnected red vertices around that are sort of irrelevant because they do not. Yeah.
I still understand that, but let me ask one more question. If there's another node pointing into that bottom node.
Yes. So one here.
It's above it.
Yes.
So it has less distinction cover than that.
Yes. That is it has to be red.
Okay, so maybe take me through the logic of that again, because I don't follow why it has to be.
Unless it slightly depends, because if you have, here I didn't group references into equivalence classes. You can group references with respect to equivalence classes of respect to pure order relations.
Strictly above.
So if you have something strictly below, it's guaranteed to be red.
Okay, sorry, can you explain that again?
Yes. So I guess we should go back here. Okay, I'm trying to remember the exact proof now. Yes, okay. So if you have something that has less power than the preparameter scenario itself, then you will have two S's that give different probabilities, but that have to be represented the same in the ontological model, which means you will have two, you will have S1 and S2 that give different probabilities for some E's, that you will have to represent nonetheless by the same ontic state distribution. And so trivially, this equality cannot hold, because here you will have something that will depend on whether you chose S1 or S2, whereas here, you will be forced by the...
Okay, I would have said the reason you restrict it to the Facebook guys is because all these other ones are just not on quantum at all. Rather than saying, oh, those are non-classical on quantum models, they don't satisfy the definition of an on quantum model. They can't reproduce the statistics.
That's once you add non-contextuality. That's once you add non-contextuality. This argument I mentioned, right, was relying on the fact that the mu of S1 and mu of S2 are the same, and that's the, right? So they do, so yes, okay, that's a good point. So although you have this sea of red nodes where red means not admitting a non-contextual ontological model, all these nodes admit an ontological model still.
Yeah, okay, no,
so, yes. Okay. okay, so that's the graph. Good, okay. So that's the end of the relative non-contextuality part. And so maybe, yes, just to give some, you know, some general remarks about it. So if you ask relative non-contextuality the question, is this preparameter scenario classical? You don't get a binary answer, yes, no. You get a graph, a colored graph, right? This sort of thing. Unless like the root is blue, then maybe, okay, maybe still it's classical, but okay, typically you get something which is a non-trivial colored graph. And so in that sense, you just don't get a binary answer, right? And we're sort of looking for this type of answer here. So what can we do? Well, we don't have much more structure to explore here to restrict. Like essentially what we want to do is restrict to some, you know, some parts of that, you know, huge infinite graph for some reasons. Maybe we want to restrict to one specific vertex, or maybe we want to restrict to like a few, but we need more structure to get there. And that's where a notion of system come into play. We'll, you know, try to look at notion of system and see, you know, whether they suggest to look at specific references or not. That's what we'll do next. So the second part is about, how to fix the reference. I mean, it's not about like how to fix, it's like, it's how to fix ? There will be some ideas, but there will be some questions as well in this part. So let me briefly mention operational non-contextuality, which is or the reduced space approach in contextuality, which is something we were doing with Misha prior to this work, which in this new work we show is equivalent as a notion to the existence, basically looking at the root of the tree, right? So this notion we had before is equivalent to saying that it's a notion of classicality that says the preparameter scenario is classical if and only if there exists a non-contextual ontological model for the preparameter scenario with respect to the reference being the preparameter scenario itself. So yeah, the root of the tree. And this approach, I mean, I think the pros are that it's very simple. It doesn't, you know, need a lot of insights from a lot of notions and so on. So in that sense, it's nice. The cons is that it's very simple, so it's not very rich, right? Like you want a notion of non-classicality and classicality that's, you know, rich and well-motivated and so on. So presumably, it would be nice to have other things in there to have a nice notion. So let's talk about notions of systems now, and we'll see. Systems will come into play because basically the operations on the system will become the reference of indistinguishability for relative non-contextuality. That will be the sort of, is everything? So the first distinction, let's say, or notions I want to talk about is the relation between the system, you know, with emphasis, like the conceptual notion of the system and the set of operations that, you know, that is related to that system, right? With which you sort of access the system, so to speak. These are the chicken and the egg, right? Which defines which? In one direction, you can say the set of operations come first, and then the system is primarily, the set of operations. And that's what I will call pragmatic system. So a pragmatic system is a system that's primarily defined by a set of operations, and possibly some other features that help to say, you know, how interesting that pragmatic system is, how fundamental it is, and so on. So it's not a blind notion of systems where anything is eligible. It's like, it's a notion in which you make a choice, but that choice is, you know, should be well motivated. And that's a type of notion that's maybe, you know, intuitive if you come from a fuzzy universe type background where you know, you think of like effective subsystems rather than fundamental subsystems. So then maybe you think that, yeah, systems, we sort of choose to restrict the scope of our operations and that defines the system. So in the other direction, we have what I call ontic systems. And ontic systems are primarily, you know, conceptual entities, and the set of operations that we assign to them comes later. So ontic systems are true, you know, things that exist out there, and the operations we assign to them are our best attempt to access that sort of, you know, true degree of freedom that exists out there. And that's a view that's very natural if you come from a composite universe type belief. And to give some further intuition as to what the difference between these two are, let's look at a particle. Right? We all love a particle. And let's look at three versions of a particle. Let's look at a classical particle described by its position momentum, a quantum particle described by its spatial wave function here, and a post-quantum particle. So I'm not allowed to tell you what the description of a post-quantum is. I can just tell you there is an X somewhere in there. And then we can ask ourselves, yeah, what are these in terms of pragmatic systems, right? And as pragmatic systems, these are all valid choices. Like a classical particle is a pragmatic system. We just say, okay, the set of operations assigned to a classical particle defines my classical particle, and that's fine. Of course, these are related choices, right? Because, I mean, in some sense, a classical particle is like a subset or like a subsystem of a quantum one and so on. And, you know, a quantum particle is more fundamental than a classical one. Arguably, I mean, maybe that depends on your interpretation of quantum mechanics, but okay. So they're not unrelated, but they're all valid. Whereas as ontic systems, the true thing is the particle. The classical particle is a naive attempt, you know, to try to, you know, touch a particle. But really, really, the true set of operations is rather the quantum set of operations. So the quantum particle is a valid ontic system, but the classical one is not. Of course, the fact that the quantum one is really the true ontic system depends on the existence of the post-quantum particle. So there's always sort of option, but okay.
Along these lines, I would have thought that a more pragmatic conception of a system would be about translating a given set of operations to not some characterization of what the system is, but what the subsystems are, right? Like, you know, you might have some set of operations, and a pragmatic viewpoint would be, oh, it is convenient to conceptualize these operations as being things done on multiple systems, or mm-hmm. as being modeled by interactions mm-hmm. between subsystems, mm-hmm. as opposed to just a single entity.
Yes.
Is that contained within this conception of a pragmatic system?
I think it's sufficiently vague for it to be contained. Sure. Yeah. In fact, like, you know, when you discuss all such notions, if you want to be any precise, there's always the question of, yeah, how is that system related to its, to the whole universe, to its neighboring systems, and so on. So it's always, yeah, like the, yeah, it's never really about one system, right? It's rather about like the relationship between larger systems, smaller systems, how they embed, how are they, yeah, how they compose, and so on, right? That's, yeah. I mean, if there's only one system, the job is done, right? There's no universe, and there's just the system, and there's no universe next to it, then usually you're just looking at the whole universe in some sense. So yeah.
Okay.
It's always about subsystems. So we have these two notions of systems, right? Pragmatic and ontic. And let's briefly discuss what it feels like, I guess, to try to do non-contextuality in one or the other approaches. And let's start with ontic system non-contextuality. I think that's the closest to most use of non-contextuality in the literature. So in this approach, you start with a proper measure scenario. So now I'm drawing sort of Venn diagrams in the space of all operations. Okay. So you have your proper measure scenario. And in ontic system non-contextuality, what you have to do is find the smallest supporting ontic system. So essentially, yeah, you have your proper measure scenario, and it's presumably a subset of a lot of other systems, but some of these are ontic systems, right? They are like, you know, like for instance, if you believe that the world is like a big tensor product of qubits, for instance, then you have your proper and measure scenario, and you have to identify how many fundamental qubits are touched by your proper and measure scenario. Okay, that's maybe a bit simple, but these sort of things, right? And then the reference, you choose it to be the set of operations, or at least your best known estimate or understanding of the set of operations of that ontic system, right? And then you evaluate non-contextuality with respect to that reference. So this notion is nice because if we agree on what the ontic systems are, it's well defined and we get definitive assessments, and that's very nice. I think the biggest open question in this approach is how well can one justify the type of ontic systems that one uses, right? Can we find like a justification based on, you know, yet other notions of, you know, locality or, you know, composition of things, what things can be taken to be independent, and so on and so forth, right? How well can we arrive at a, you know, clear methodology and justification for the type of partitioning of the universe that we are using in ontic systems, right? I mean, this is not a choice in the ontic system. In the ontic system approach, you're not choosing to partition the universe, really, right? But still, you can explain, you know, sort of where it comes from and how it connects to other notions. Okay. Now let's look at pragmatic non-contextuality, which is non-contextuality with respect to pragmatic systems. So again, you start with your proper measure scenario, and then you choose, you know, some pragmatic systems in which you just choose some that are related to your proper measure scenario, presumably, and you know, this system maybe is associated to some interesting task, maybe this one is some interesting concurrent theory that you want to look at, and so on, right? And then for each pragmatic system choice, you get a reference. Basically, the reference is, again, the set of operations of the system, which is, in that case, well-known, right? Because in the ontic system case, you may not know the true, you know, set of operations of the system, but here, because you chose it, you sort of get rid of that sort of assumption. So now the problem potentially is that you may get, you know, different assessments of non-classicality respective to each system you choose. So I think the most important open question there is, suppose we, if this pragmatic system is the one that lets you do perfect distinguishability, then trivially you get, you know, classicality. And if this one is, you know, something else, maybe you get non-classicality, so you get maybe conflicting assessments in that case. But the perfect distinguishability case is sort of very easy to rule out pragmatically, like the lab notebook argument. I mean, just throw it out, right? The lab notebook. It's very easy to rule that out. So the question is, suppose we restrict our pragmatic systems to well-justified ones. And the question is sort of, again, that's basically the same question as before. How do we do that, and how well can we, you know, do it from sort of first principles? That restriction is already like one open question in some sense. But then the later question is, do we get then verdicts of non-contextuality that are consistent with one another, right? Like suppose that the prepared measure scenario embeds in two well-justified in some sort of framework pragmatic systems that maybe are different. Do we nonetheless get consistent assignments of non-contextuality or not, right? That's sort of the question. And very hypothetically, I would like to mention the option that suppose you have like well-justified pragmatic systems and nonetheless you get inconsistent verdicts of non-contextuality. That's probably unlikely to happen, right? I would guess. But suppose it happens. There's an interesting option that we can look at in this case, which is traditionally, our notion of systems influences our assessments of non-contextuality. But because now with pragmatic systems, we are choosing our systems, right? Well, our assessments of non-contextuality can influence backwards our choice of systems. So we can look back at our choice of system and say, if all things are equal, right, between two systems, and they only differ by one is non-contextual, one is contextual, then why not choose the non-contextual one, right? They are sort of much easier to understand, maybe, and so on, right? So that's hypothetical, but that's sort of a logically possible thing that you can do in this approach. How am I doing on time?
Okay.
Okay, perfect, perfect. So now let's look at, so that's like the last notion here of the second part, which is local non-contextuality, which is not very descriptive, but this is just to, you know, maybe you think there's like a one-line argument invoking like locality where you say, ah, but the previous image scenario happened somewhere, just look at everything there, right? So something like that. This slide is to show some, you know, perhaps limitations to such a simple argument, which is not to say that there's, you know, there's probably more to say about locality, right? But okay. So suppose your methodology from contextuality is the following. You have your prepared image scenario, and you assign to it a, so now this is a space-time, or a space, but the slide is a space diagram, so X and Y. You assign a space region to your prepared image scenario, and then you just say, well, okay, I will take my reference to be all the procedures. So really you have, to each procedure, you have a way to assign, you know, a space-time region, basically, like a bit like you do in algebraic QFT, I think. Yeah, and then you just take the reference to be all the procedures on that region, right? That sort of makes sense. And then you evaluate non-contextuality with respect to that. Well, this has some limitations, because if you think about it, where is the experimentalist here? Where is Alice? Alice is, you know, on the side physically of that region. She's interacting with a black box, maybe, that she's pressing some button that then, you know, sends, you know, I don't know, photons, waves, stuff to that region. So actually the region of space-time that at the very beginning we assigned to the prepared measure scenario, in this picture it looks like a cut in a measurement chain, right? Like kind of like a Heisenberg cut type of thing. And importantly, also with respect to the very first slide, this cut is, it's not just a macroscopic cut, right? It's not enough to say like, yeah, throw out everything that's sort of macroscopically separated. You sort of need to also have some idea of, you know, at the microscopic scale, if you have a microscopic type assignment of the region, you need to say what happens there. So there are other possible cuts you could employ, right? And so essentially we fall back on, you know, essentially the same discussion as we had before. Is there like a true fundamental, you know, space-time region associated to each procedure? Is this a pragmatic choice? How well can we justify it? And so on and so forth. So this is just to say that locality on its own, just sort of trivially like that, I don't think it solves all the other aspects. But this is not to say that it cannot enrich, and probably does enrich all the discussions. And I'm guessing that good justifications of systems and so on certainly involve some notion of locality, space-time symmetries, and stuff like that. So yeah. This should not be understood too pessimistically, right? Yes. Okay, so that's the end of part two, or at the end of the talk. Let me just give two sort of main, I think, what are the two main steps, future steps in this sort of direction. The first is the easiest one. The next one is harder, so yeah. The question is, yeah, what do prepared transform and measure scenario add to this discussion, essentially? So we restricted the scope to prepared measure scenarios, both for simplicity and because we believe that, you know, well, you can already make an interesting discussion there. But what did we miss? Did we miss, you know, very important things that completely change the picture if we include, you know, transformation and composition and so on? Or is this not really the case? Well, that's sort of open, I think, and it'd be very interesting to look at. And the really, really big question, which I think is probably very hard, but extremely interesting, and probably very, can probably get a lot of insights from there, is can we get a clear methodology of, you know, individuation, that's sometimes called, like, can we get a clear methodology for, you know, partitioning the universe in systems and subsystems and so on, right? And this, you know, that's basically asking for some sort of reconstruction of quantum theory type arguments, so, you know, big questions, not easy to tackle. But, you know, there's work on reconstruction of quantum theory. Probably things can be borrowed from there, concepts, ideas of what type of requirements you can bring in to try to make it work and so on. So yeah, I think this would be the most interesting thing. And then of course, look at how it impacts non-contextuality, right? Like how it plays out with the assessments of classicality and so on. Okay, so thanks a lot for your attention.
Yeah, go ahead.
the stuff in the chat.
I have an issue online that when I'm hearing the questions over the room speaker.
Uh-huh.
So people start raising your hands, and anyone online, if you want to raise your hands, just mark it. What I'll have you do is turn off your microphone.
Ah, yes.
But only if we got a question online, so not right now. And then I'll use the laptop microphone and speakers, and we'll do that.
Okay, great.
But yeah, right.
So I wanted to get back to what you're saying. If you have different pragmatic notions of systems, then some are clearly not so good, like the one about the notebook.
Mm-hmm.
But what sort of principles are you appealing to in kind of assessing the quality of a reference set? Because if I ask myself, like, what's wrong about the idea that I have a measurement that accesses a notebook, I basically fall back to my notion that, the organizing principle is the system, that the system is the thing that mediates between the preparation and measurement. And so when I do measurements on a spin, I'm not doing measurements on a lot of notebook.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it seems to me that you didn't want to appeal to the notion of an ontic system. So what do you have, if you're not going to appeal to the notion of an ontic system, what sorts of principles can you use to adjudicate between different choices of reference systems?
That's if I had the question, if I had the full answer, the talk would be very different. So I don't have the full answer, right? So for the lab notebook specifically, I would say that you can probably appeal to locality, in some principle of locality. You can say that it's very clear that maybe you don't know exactly, like on a macroscopic scale, where you're influencing things in your preparation scenario, but clearly you're not influencing the lab notebook, right? You can just move it arbitrarily far and you can sort of control what happens to the lab notebook and so on. So I think the lab notebook is very easy to rule out based on probably sort of any actually extra principle you bring in, right? So the lab notebook is like an easy, I think it's easy to rule out. The questions are like, yeah, what kind of principle should we appeal to more generally to rule out different types of pragmatic systems? And okay, also I don't know, but I'm guessing notions of locality, notions of maybe symmetries, looking at, maybe the framework is just too blind. Maybe there's like a better framework where we can look at not just preparation scenario, but more complicated scenarios where the reference and the preparation scenarios are more related. For instance, you could say the reference should be some sort of closure, like the reference effect should be some sort of closure of the prepare and measure effect with respect to some notion of composition or something like that. It's always a question of closure, right? Like the locality thing is close your prepare and measure scenario on that region. The ontic system thing is close your operations with respect to that ontic system and so on and so forth. Right? So the question is, what do we close with respect to with respect to? That's I don't know exactly, right? But that's I think.
Okay. Let me ask a second follow-up question. See, and you already kind of anticipated or partly answered it. That it was about your notion of local non-contextuality. If I understood it correctly, I was going to kind of criticize it based on the notebook example. That if all I sort of care about is that the sets of measurements I should consider. You have your SPM and your EPM, which are kind of the actual experiments you did, and then you say, but now let's consider the sort of possibilities of all preparation measurements in this spatial temporal region that they lived in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if my notebook happens to be in that spatial temporal region, then I get the notebook problem. That the measurements could depend on the notebook and everything was possible. The fact that I could move the notebook away seems there would be ways of doing the experiment that wouldn't get into this trap. But there's also ways of doing it where the notebook's there in that space-time region. So it feels to me like just appealing to locality is not enough. Like appealing to some system that mediates influence between the preparation and measurement is a lot stronger because it's not about the fact that the measurement is in the causal future of the preparation, right? Like in principle, details about what I prepared could make it to the future and inform the measurement. But usually we say, this organizing principle of the system is what tells me that, in fact, there were no such influences because there was no trace of what I prepared kind of left over in the state of that system.
Yeah.
So usually I would say this sort of talk about causal mediaries is going beyond just locality.
Yes.
And it seems to me that you'll need a principle that's stronger than locality to rule out the notebook.
So I guess there are different flavors of the lab notebook, right? Because there's the the physical lab notebook that you can throw out.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, like if you, I mean, what there could be like a small lab notebook, you know, a macroscopic one, very close, right? That always records everything you do, but that's like very conspirational. So maybe again,
the physical configuration of your preparation device is a record of what the physical configuration of preparation device was.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, and it's in the causal path of all your measures.
Yes. Yes. So yeah, exactly. So in that sense, yeah, that's why, I mean, yeah, that's one of the message here, right? Like locality on its own, or at least simple appeals to locality do not seem to be enough because they don't really resolve all of the ambiguities. But you know, if you believe in a framework like maybe like algebraic QFT, where really like each procedure really happens on a region, like a bounded region of space-time, then I think you can very easily derive the result of contextuality in that case. But then the problem is that you're sort of hiding some of this discussion in, you know, the assumptions you make in the very first step when you assign the region, the procedure, and so on. So, yeah, I think it's not enough on its own locality, but still, it's probably something that is probably like a potential tool that one should maybe keep in the back of the mind, and maybe like if it can be helpful, I think it should be used.
I want to allow some online speakers.
Yes.
We've got David Schmidt. You want to try?
Sorry, let me.
All right. So yeah, very nice talk. It was very clear. So I just wanted to make a comment on this lab notebook example. So actually, this example inspired John Selby and I to write a paper which hasn't appeared on the archive yet, but it should appear in a week or so, which basically we show that this lab notebook example does not, in fact, support the conclusions that it's typically been thought to support, like the one that you mentioned in your talk. So the usual idea is that if there exists some system with classical records and you consider measurements on that system, then there will always be a non-contextual model for the experiment. But what we show in this forthcoming paper is that argument relies on the idea that all operational equivalences are sort of these convex or linear mixtures, linear constraints on the states and effects. But there's actually more general kinds of operational equivalences that arise when you consider partial traces as well. And so if you just put together these kind of partial trace kind of equivalences and these linear constraint kinds of equivalences, then even if you consider these lab notebook systems, it's possible to, basically you can show that if there's a proof of contextuality when there's no lab notebook, then even if you include the lab notebook as a physical system, you can still get a proof of contextuality.
Yeah, you try.
Okay, I'll try to unmute. Hi, David. I hope you can hear me. Thanks a lot for the remark. Indeed. David shared with me this preprint. I got to see this nice argument. And indeed, as we will all see, right, when the paper comes out, we can rule out the lab notebook even by allowing it to be there, but using this extra partial traces related constraints. I would say that in the context of the discussion of this talk, these partial traces are, I mean, they go beyond, what I was describing, and I believe that it's meaningful to say that these partial traces relate to some notion of discarding of systems, which, you know, relates to notions of systems as well. So, I guess it would be particularly interesting to see how this argument plays out when in the context of being very very explicit about the system and so on, right? But indeed, yeah. Thank you for this remark. This would be very interesting to look at.
Can
yes.
Great. If I can just maybe add to what you just said, it seems to me that this lab notebook, or this kind of lab notebook, which is no longer really a problem, maybe it could be more clear that it's not a problem from this kind of ontic systems perspective that you've taken. So as you mentioned, the partial trace kind of assumes some subsystem structure, and I think it might only be there in this ontic, as you say, is the one that is typically associated with generalized contextuality. second thing is, you might still, this kind of discussion might not even make sense to someone who's committed to the fuzzy universe picture, but I think it's fair to say that the lab, for example, can't be leveraged as an argument against the ontic systems perspective.
Yes, I completely agree with what you just said. And I would add that actually your argument is probably, I mean, you know, you can I'm guessing that it can be extended even in some of these other approaches, like this pragmatic system or local system and so on approaches. So even in I think even in a fuzzy universe, to some extent, you can probably rule out this level. I mean, I'm pretty sure that one can do it even in the fuzzy universe. So I think that your argument is probably valid even beyond ontic system. I mean, maybe not like the precise. I mean, okay, maybe not the one you precisely stated, right? But like some conceptually similar version of it is probably applicable beyond ontic systems as well. There are so many things that one can appeal, right, to probably rule it out that I doubt it's an argument that can survive very long, even in the other approaches. Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you.
Other questions from online?
Other questions from her?
Yeah, I've got a couple. So I'm sort of in the camp of the belief that a lot of these conundrums regarding systems that emerge in this sort of locality context emerge from, like, are really just the same problem of trying to understand independence, of trying to understand how do you characterize when a given preparation procedure is the same as an independent kind of combination of other preparation procedures. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, in this sort of at this abstract level, there's no relationship between preparation procedures other than how they interact with the measurement effects, mm-hmm. for example. And the reference system adds constraints on the kinds of models you might derive. But mm-hmm. at no point is there any implicit sort of relationship or mathematical structure between different sets of events just on the basis of independence. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that'd be the kind of thing that you would need to include necessarily in order to incorporate these kinds of like external justifications for wanting formal mm-hmm. complex combinations of effects and preparations internally. Like, because you say you want to have a framework mm-hmm. and accommodate the idea of independent classical randomness, that mm-hmm. number, you know, pseudo-random number generator, mm-hmm. peel in and study that way. It should be in principle possible to model those internal to your set of, say, preparation procedures. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
One of them includes draw sample.
Yeah.
And condition
exactly.
certain things, mm-hmm. do something else. And as soon as you incorporate that in, you then need to have this infinite family of different preparation procedures that correspond to, you know, all of the different effects that happen when you do it independently.
Yeah.
Right? And I think finding ways to model independence internal to this abstract framework, mm-hmm. these abstract kind of frameworks, mm-hmm. leads you to understanding ways that you carve up the concepts of systems.
Yeah.
Right? Because they are entities that enable you to, you know, ratify your notions of independence in your probabilities, in some sense. Like you might see correlations between two different effects, but if there's a preparation, for example, that enables you to decouple, like mm-hmm. make those mm-hmm. independent,
yeah.
Then that leads you to say things like, oh, maybe this kind of preparation really is a localized system because yeah. it enables me to decouple all these different probabilities.
Yes.
And so it seems like that might be an extra sugar, an extra
yes.
on top of this kind of abstract framework. Yeah. I'm wondering, have you thought about that? And if so, how would you encode that? Because
yeah.
I think references, like this appeal to a privileged set of preparations and effects that serve as a reference for stuff can actually serve as a tool for articulating what exactly should be considered independent.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, that's a very, I mean, yeah, that, these are all extremely interesting and interesting thoughts that one should really follow up on, right? And maybe I should say already that there's this, to some extent, there's this paper about, I call it the omelette paper in my mind. It's unscrambling the omelette of causation and inference. Mm-hmm. And more generally, there's also just the notion of, you know, causal inference and so on, and causal models. I mean, all these notions, yeah, exactly, right? These are the sort of things that we would hope we can add. It's not just sugar, right? I think it's the actual content of the meal. So it's not just sugar. It's like really, this would really, significantly enrich the discussion, and this would be very interesting to look at. And indeed, in the very beginning, right, the operational formalism we introduced, is just asking for more. It's going very slow. Many animations. Yes. So yeah, I mean, as you say, right? There's already like the we already have introduced two potentially different representations of the same thing, which is classical randomness. Mm-hmm. So there should be some sort of equivalence relation on the operations that, you know, serves to identify these things, and we can quotient with respect to that, and so on and so forth, right? And I think this is extremely interesting. I think to some extent it's probably a little bit done already out there in some of these papers. I'm not sure, but yeah, completely. Like this would be a first step. So yeah, so codify these different views of classical randomness. But maybe that's not so interesting. Maybe the independence one is really the most interesting. Like you can have like independence with respect to some stuff, and then right. And I mean yeah, and the story goes on and yeah. I guess it can get complicated at some point, but yeah.
It seems sort of like right at the beginning, you commit to, at the very minimal setting, at least one concept of a system, which is like a source of randomness that I can use in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else you might, you know, consider what is a good notion of a system or a good notion of a reference. But already at the start, you've committed to some conception of what that there exist certain kinds of systems with very regulated behavior,
yeah.
And I can always model them faithfully in an architectural way within
yeah.
the ontological model.
Well, that is to some extent to be able to fit, because I mean, at some point, there's also the avengers, like, do you want to do like full reconstructions of like, systems from operational perspective,
mm-hmm.
and or do you want to do that in a way where you can talk about non-contextuality all the way, right? And so here, like, the goal is to do things very operationally, but still in a way where you have enough structure to be able to talk about.
Right.
So you need this sort of convex structure for non-contextuality, otherwise you would sort of lose.
I know. It's
but
minimal,
yeah.
In that respect.
About appealing to locality by way of steering. I'm trying to cast the bound on locality experiment almost as a contextual experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea would be that the bound has different choices of measurement that it can do. And every time it chooses one and gets an outcome, we consider that a preparation for how it's been measured. And it seems like the argument, which is if we forget about the outcome of Bob's measurement, so we consider all the outcomes from one basis and all the outcomes from the other basis, surely the sort of mixture of those preparations weighted by their occurrences,
mm-hmm.
which corresponds to sort of being completely ignorant about it, could we argue that represents like the same preparation procedure, which is Bob measures this way and forgets the outcome, Bob measures that way and forgets the outcome.
Yeah, that would work.
So this is limited because you can't like take arbitrary Cochin Specker type things where I want to say, like, here's a preparation, it's a particular pure state preparation, and argue that whether I am preparing it in this basis or the other basis, it's the same preparation. Because here, sort of the things that we're able to establish equivalence thing are only the very, very noisy, very mixed preparations. Like, that's where we're going to establish equivalences on.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a form of equivalence which does power some forms of
control. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's interesting. I forgot. I think I thought about that, but we discussed that with Michel at some point, I think, but I forgot exactly what our conclusions were. But yeah, the steering case is interesting in particular, because then you can maybe appeal to a notion of macroscopic locality, and maybe you can say something like, so the reference would be like all measurements on Bob's side, not on Alice's side. And then because they are like maybe spatially separated, maybe that's easier to define than the macroscopic locality thing. Yeah, I'd have to think about it. I forgot about it. But yeah, I mean, certainly this sort of, that's so more generally, right? Trying to think about it, embedding preparations as, I mean, connecting that to more general notions, for instance, a steering scenario is certainly, that's certainly something that can probably enrich the discussion a lot. And I'm not sure exactly, I don't actually know what the conclusions would be there, but that's, very interesting to look at.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Victor.
Thank you.
Victor will be here for the next 2 weeks or so. Continue the conversation.
And we'll probably head down to lunch now, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
So you want to join for lunch. Thanks. Stand there in a few minutes.
Thanks.